You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Death is said to be the great equalizer, but as Marilyn Yalom explains in her latest book, cemeteries can be anything but equal. They can be an attempt to carry one's wealth and position beyond the grave. The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds, is published by Houghton Mifflin, and Marilyn Yalom joins me now once again on this show. Her son, by the way, Reed Yalom, contributed photographs to this book, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to this show. The photographs are really nice. They add an element that you haven't had in your previous books.
Yes, it was a surprise to me to discover the extent to which the photos would be a parallel narrative to my own text and not merely illustrative of the text. I'm very grateful to Houghton Mifflin for presenting the book in a beautiful, beautiful format.
And we, by the way, we have a slideshow of the photos on our show page at WNYC.org. You've written many books and articles on literature and women's history. The last time you were here, we talked about the birth of the chess queen, your history of chess through a feminist perspective. How did you wind up writing about cemeteries?
It was my mother's death 11 years ago that introduced me to cemeteries, or reintroduced me to cemeteries, because I've always enjoyed walking in cemeteries and reading the inscriptions. My mother's buried within walking distance of my home in Palo Alto, and I would go there frequently, discover the different offerings that people would leave during the course of a year, the different ethnic groups, different religions, and originally wanted to do something called A Year in the Life of a Cemetery.
And are cemeteries very different depending on the ethnic group, the religion, or the region that they're in, for that matter?
They're very different depending upon the time to begin with. And I trace 400 years of cemetery history from 1607 to 2007. The cemeteries that you find from the 17th century, say in New England, are very grim, forbidding places with death's heads carved into the stone. And then if you look at the beautiful 19th century garden cemeteries that started also in the New England area but then went to the south and all over the country, that has a very different feel with trees and shrubs and a much more optimistic picture of the world. And then, of course...
Well, that means it reflects changing attitudes about our relation to religion, to death, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So how much of cemeteries a reflection of that? There was an article in today's New York Times about an ancient city in Turkey where the dead were cremated. Not all cultures bury their dead. The Semites to the south forbade cremation because they had different religious beliefs. It depended, in this case, on whether you believe the soul and body are one, and that led to burial, or whether you believe that they were separate, as in Hinduism and some other religions, and cremation was the result.
Well, cremation is becoming increasingly popular, even in this country. The statistics show that about 1 in 3 Americans now are being cremated. And on the West Coast where I live, about 50%.
Is that because people are aware of the fact that they take up space when they're buried in
yes,
the cemetery?
Yes, they take up space. And I think it's also the influence from Asia, where cremation, particularly among the Japanese, for example, and the Indians, the Hindus, where cremation is the norm. So the whole issue of taking up space and cremation is less expensive. You don't have to necessarily put up a tombstone or have a coffin. And, of course, now there are green burials, which are either in the form of cremation or of body burial, where one is buried in biodegradable materials, and very often you do not place a tombstone, but you'll plant a bush or a tree. So there is quite a variety.
But there's always been biodegradable burials. It depended on whether you buried somebody in a pine box or whether you buried them in an iron casket.
Indeed. And the iron casket ideal developed in the late 19th century among the affluent. Everything to protect the body from decaying. And that continued right into the 20th century with embalming and other methods.
Almost a return to what the ancient Egyptians were doing.
Yes, preserve the body even if we weren't mummifying it. Place it in a vault, sometimes so ornate that it looked like a mini mansion. And now we're seeing a movement away from that towards simpler forms of burial and simpler forms of monuments, including those that are just flush with the grass.
You've been suggesting that there are changes, and your subtitle is 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds. So let's go back to before the Europeans even came here. How did Native Americans bury their dead?
Our book begins with a picture of a Native American burial mound in the Mississippi area, actually. It's in northern Georgia. The Native Americans of that region, the Mississippians, buried their dead in layers. And once one layer was filled up, then they would cover it with dirt. Well, they'd cover individuals with dirt. And then they'd start on a second layer and a third, bringing the dirt from what were called borrow pits. Sometimes those mounds rose as high as 40, 50, and 60 feet, and they were still here in the 16th century when the Spanish explorers came through the south. But gradually, with development, with farming, most of them have been flattened. Of course, this is the only way that Native Americans buried their dead. They also, particularly in the West and the Plains area, they would expose their dead on stilts, for example, or in trees. And so there was more than one way. But the mounds, to me, the reason I wanted to start our book with the mounds is I wanted to have the feeling of the earth, of humus, humankind. And that is, of course, what was claimed by the Europeans when they came here with their idea of the burial ground.
But you say that it's hard to find the graves of the early American settlers. Why is that?
Well, as I say, many of them were flattened, have disappeared. The Native American settlements themselves disappeared, and we don't always know why.
No, but I asked you about the early settlers,
the
Europeans. I was surprised to learn that they didn't think they were going to be here forever, and so they didn't really want to be buried here.
That's true, particularly of the Spaniards, who buried their dead without markers or with simple crosses that disintegrated over time. In time, the Spaniards, too, began to build missions, and the missions had churches, and they had the Campo Santo, the sacred field right next to the church. Interestingly, and not surprisingly, the Spanish themselves were buried under the boards of the church, whereas the converted natives were put in shrouds at best and put out in the Campo Santo, and their graves were not marked.
The Chinese, for many years, sent their bones back to China.
Yes, and that's very interesting. It's something that I discovered in Hawaii at one of the Chinese cemeteries on Oahu. The idea was that your bones should be sent back to your native village. That the spirit will not rest until it returns to its birthplace. And that's, by the way, an idea that you find in other cultures, not only among the Chinese. So you'd come as a worker to Hawaii, and then you would be buried temporarily in the late 19th, early 20th century. And at some point, your bones were dug up, and someone would carry them back to your native village. But other times, many times, this didn't happen. And so you have, in one of the cemeteries we visited, a place where the bones are in storage in suitcases and in vats, and that haven't been returned.
My guest is Marilyn Yalom, who has written The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds, with photographs by her son Reed Yalom, published by Houghton Mifflin. When did people start marking graves with headstones? And can you tell us about the evolution of what has been written on those headstones over the years?
The headstones came into being with the Anglo-Americans coming to the colonies in particularly in New England, 1620s, 1630s. And we still have many of those tombstones erect in Boston, also in Rhode Island, some in New York. And what's interesting about them is at first they're really quite simple. They're slate slabs with the name and the dates of birth and death, and sometimes the age at which the person died. They become more elaborate over time, as one would expect. And what you do find on these stones is one image consistently, and that's the image of the death's head. The death's head is a skull with wings, the skull to remind us of mortality, and certainly the Puritans never forgot that, and the wings suggesting the possibility for resurrection. Gravestones were very similar in the North and in the South. And you find some of the carvings, some of the carvers from the North sent their stones as far as the South, because in places like Tidewater, Maryland, and Virginia, they didn't have stone. Or stones were sent over from England. And then, although the Puritan ideal was simple and sober, those tombstones, not only among Puritans, but among other Protestant sects, and of course Catholics as well, and Jews, they became more elaborate in time.
And epitaphs become freer, kind of, in some cases, almost irreverent, which is kind of shocking to me. You say people could be excluded from some cemeteries, and not just for religious reasons.
Well, cemeteries were very exclusive places, mostly for religious reasons. You have, I think of what I saw in the Gold Country. This is, of course, the 19th century. But you have the large Protestant cemetery in Jackson, California, with rather secular epitaphs. And right next to it, you have the somewhat smaller Catholic cemetery with the traditional crosses and images of the Virgin Mary and Jesus. And then on the other side, a very small Jewish cemetery where the inscriptions are in Hebrew and in English and sometimes in German.
But sometimes Protestants who are black would not be buried in white cemeteries. In fact, you suggest that all of the cultural norms were extended into the grave, segregation being one of them. In Chicago, cemeteries were divided by class as well as ethnicity.
Well, they are all over divided by class and certainly by ethnicity up until the 1950s, and that was true in the North and in the South. We had a hard time finding old black cemeteries. Slaves, for the most part, they buried each other, and they buried each other in fields and forests and, for the most part, in unmarked graves. So,
which led to the fight over the burial ground in downtown Manhattan.
And well, that's a perfect example of what happened. On one side of Wall Street, you've got Trinity Church and Churchyard, founded in 1696 with the stipulation, quote, that no Negro shall be buried in Trinity Churchyard. And on the other side of Wall Street, you had what was called the African American Burial Ground, which in time was paved over and forgotten about and only rediscovered in the 1990s. And then about 400 bodies were dug up and an estimated 20,000 or 15,000 to 20,000 have been left untouched. But now there's at least a marker indicating that that was the, quote, Negro's burial ground.
We still have something similar happening here in New York in the Potter's Field on Hart Island, where people are buried without any markers. Adults are buried three deep. Children, I think it's five deep for babies. Many of the bodies buried there were children born who died at birth. The island's off limits to the public, although family members who can prove that their relatives are buried there are able to arrange a visit. It's hard to prove it because there are just handwritten records.
Yes, that's true of Potter's Fields and cemeteries for the indigent throughout the country. New York City is very special in what has happened to its dead. At one time, there were as many as 100 cemeteries in Manhattan alone.
What's happened to them? Now most of the cemeteries are in Queens and Staten
Island,
aren't they?
Exactly. In the 19th century, for sanitary reasons, but I think even more so because of the price of real estate, bodies were disinterred and moved out to the suburbs. And the congregations, whether they were Protestant or Catholic or Jewish, sold off their lands so that now there are very few cemeteries in Manhattan.
Except the historical ones, the first Jewish cemetery, the cemeteries behind some very old churches.
Yes, there are a very few. But most of the bones were sent off to the outlying boroughs. And so now we all know that as you come in from the airport into Manhattan, you see Calvary Cemetery with over 3 million graves. So it's a very – to be a cemetery buff in this city, you have to really go out on and do your detective work.
There have been changing styles. You described the new burying ground cemetery in New Haven, Connecticut, as being part of a revolution in American cemeteries.
Yes, the Grove Cemetery in New Haven was one of the first to place the graves outside of the city, which, of course, now means about a mile away from Yale University. The movement of the 19th century was toward what was called the rural or the garden cemetery. The first one was the Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, which was founded by a group of horticulturists, and it now has over 100 acres and some of the most prominent members of 19th century society, people like Oliver Wendell Holmes or Longfellow, and Mary Baker Eddy, of course. And it's just one of the gorgeous rural cemeteries where the emphasis is on nature, trees, flowers.
We have one in Brooklyn, don't we? Greenwood Cemetery.
Yes, exactly.
A very large cemetery that's a garden cemetery.
Exactly. All of which were based on the model of Mount Auburn. And if you want to see cemeteries as they were in the 19th century, you can find a garden cemetery in almost every major city. And remember that that was the time before public parks and public museums, and so people would go to these cemeteries for nature walks, even sometimes for picnics, and to admire the sculpture.
What about memorial parks? How are they different from garden cemeteries?
Memorial parks, which came from Southern California and the famous Forest Lawn, have flat stones, either out of stone or out of metal. And these are very small, and they lie flush with the grass. So the emphasis is upon the planet, if you will, but mainly easy maintenance, that you can have sprinklers and you can have power mowers and you can pack people together.
And we see military cemeteries like that.
Yes, that's true, though military cemeteries usually have crosses or some indication of religion. And now you have more than the three dominant religions. You can be buried under even a witch's symbol.
Marilyn Yalom's book, The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds, is published by Houghton Mifflin and has photographs by Reed Yalom. And you can see some of those photographs on our show page at WNYC.org. We didn't get to some of the very special cemeteries that you talk about here, but that's why people read these books. I thank you so much for being with us today.
It was very nice. Thank you.
Up next, a look at the legal ins and outs of Saddam Hussein's trial and execution. I'll talk to law professor Michael Newton, who helped write the laws and the rules of the Iraqi High Tribunal for the trial. This is WNYC, WNYC.org.